From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Later today, House lawmakers will take the unusual step of voting on a measure to remove freshman Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene from her two congressional committees. Democrats and even some Republicans are outraged over past comments she made calling for violence against Democrats and her support for bizarre conspiracy theories. In an hours-long meeting last night, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy condemned the conspiracy theories, but he did not take away Taylor Greene's committee assignments. He also stood by his deputy, Liz Cheney, even though 61 Republicans voted to remove her from leadership because she supported impeaching Donald Trump a second time. Let's hear from a Republican. Former Congressman Carlos Curbelo represented South Florida up until 2019. He joins us on Skype. Mr. Curbelo, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And if you were still in the House, would you stand up as a Republican and vote later today to remove Marjorie Taylor Greene from her committees?
Well, what I would have done is advocated stridently for the party internally to strip her of her committees. There's a standard for this kind of behavior in the House. Leader McCarthy last Congress stripped former Congressman Steve King of his committees and then engaged against him in his primary, and Republicans defeated Steve King in a primary. So that's how this should have been handled. I do have some concerns with the precedent of the entire House, meaning the majority party, voting to strip a member of the minority party of their committees.
What's the difference between what happened with Steve King and what's happening here with Marjorie Taylor Greene? I mean, what has shifted in Washington that Leader McCarthy is now unwilling to stand up against her?
Well, the technical difference that some members will point to is that there are no standards for comments made prior to membership in the House. And some members I've spoken to have said that she did say some horrible things that they would never defend, but those statements preceded her election and her membership in the House. Now, in terms of the environment in Washington, D.C., what has changed is the effect that Donald Trump and his movement have had on our institutions. And we have essentially lowered all our standards, and it's frustrating and it's unhealthy.
Well, somehow Kevin McCarthy managed to defend those two women on two different sides of the party. And some Republicans, like Congressman Adam Kinzinger, said the way that he handled this was embarrassing. But how would you grade McCarthy's leadership here?
Well, Leader McCarthy is in a very difficult position, and I think we all have to acknowledge that. The Republican Party is diverse and not necessarily in a desirable way these days. For now, he has avoided further conflict. But the absence of conflict is not the presence of peace and stability. And I think it's very important for Republicans to understand that there will only be peace and stability in a coherent, durable party or House Republican Conference, in this case, when Republicans can openly and freely acknowledge and embrace truth, facts, and science.
So the question is, by avoiding that conflict, has he not only weakened himself, but also weakened the party and emboldened fringe members of your party?
That's right. It's just not sustainable in the long term. The Republican Party cannot offer the American people a clear and attractive alternative to the Democratic Party as long as they remain unable to commit to simple truths, to expressing obvious truths in public, like the fact that Joe Biden won the presidential election in 2020.
Looking ahead to this evening, what do you think is going through every Republican's mind in the House right now as they prepare for that vote on the record to decide whether Marjorie Taylor Greene should be kicked off those committees?
So you won't hear very many of any Republicans defending the Congresswoman's statements. What you will likely hear is a lot of process arguments that a future Republican majority could sideline Democratic members of the House. Now, at the same time, I think Democrats can justify this move, given that this is someone who has, in some cases, endorsed violence against members of Congress. This is a tough vote, I think, for every member because of the precedent it sets for the House.
Carlos Curbelo, former Republican congressman from Florida. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Let's turn now to San Francisco, California, where the debate over how to open schools safely is getting litigious. The city of San Francisco is suing its own school district and school board in an effort to accelerate a return to in-person learning. Here's the city's attorney, Dennis Herrera, yesterday.
The plan prepared by the San Francisco Unified School District and adopted by the Board of Education is ambiguous, empty rhetoric. It is a plan to make a plan and is legally insufficient.
San Francisco School Board President Gabriela Lopez, however, says there is a plan in place. She joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So the city says the school district doesn't really have a plan to return to the classroom, but rather has what Herrera called a plan to make a plan. You say that's not the case. So what is the plan?
Yeah, so we have indeed made progress that shows exactly what we need in our school buildings, the supplies that we've provided, the progress we've, of course, made with our educators, the plans to connect and communicate with our families. Our staff is ready to go. They've gone through all of the training, all of the various steps that's required to return to in-person learning. So when I heard this, my initial reaction is really a frivolous lawsuit that doesn't benefit our community and further divides the city and the school district.
Would you have a target date to get back in the classroom?
So at this moment, we're waiting on a few more things with our educators to ensure their ultimate safety in returning. And I think what we failed to recognize is that many of our school buildings haven't been the safest environments for a long time. And we've been met with that challenge now during the pandemic. So we have to instill that confidence in our educators. And as a school district, we've been meeting it in repairing our buildings and, of course, including the additional safety protocols. And once that is instilled and ensured, we'll definitely have a date to return.
Are there certain benchmarks then that you're looking for? You know, we want the infection rate to get, you know, to a certain low point, or the vaccination rate to get to a certain high point. And we know that would trigger the conditions for a return.
That's right. One thing that is really important is community spread and ensuring we decrease that as much as possible as a city. Another issue has been low barrier testing and vaccine availability that the city and county of San Francisco hasn't been able to provide, let alone the state. So we don't see that in our school district happening soon unless we really put the pressure on the city, or the city puts the pressure on the state to ensure we have those tools.
We did see the CDC publish a study last week that showed COVID-19 transmission rates are pretty low in schools and that they could open to in-person learning when possible. And we also just yesterday saw the state's governor, Gavin Newsom, say that schools can safely reopen even if all the teachers aren't vaccinated. So what do you make of that?
What we've been understanding, and what I know as a former teacher in the school district, is, again, this safety piece and the trust that the school district can provide that for our educators is important. And I know a big fear is, even when we head back, the chance of getting COVID and bringing it home to family members who don't live or work in the same safe working conditions is really frightening and, of course, very fearful for a lot of people.
You know, on the one side, you've got this pressure from city leaders to reopen. And on the other side, you've got the teachers union that wants educators to get vaccinated first. So do you feel stuck in the middle? And can you work with both of these constituencies?
There's actually no way of returning if we are divided as the city is making us be right now. One thing that we're also forgetting is educational institutions are now acting like departments of public health. And we've been in many situations where we've had to go through a competitive bidding process on our own instead of being provided the services from our city. So communicating our needs is a priority and ensuring that we're working together, but we also need the city to step up when we're asking for this help.
What are you hearing from parents, especially the ones who feel that their kids are falling behind academically and socially by not being in the classroom?
We are living under really horrible times, especially when it comes to our learning. And I know parents are asking and demanding that we make it clear where we are in this process. But I am also hearing from other families who are definitely not interested in returning right now. That's the fear that I'm hearing on both sides. There's one who absolutely does not want to risk that, because if their family gets it, it could be detrimental to their survival. And then there's the other side who I know is also suffering because learning during this time is just not as adequate, of course, as we've been accustomed to.
Gabriella, so what comes next in this lawsuit? I mean, how will you and the district respond?
So unfortunately, what it increases is more work and more attention paid to something that we've already been able to do. What we're going to continue to do is really work to show that we're meeting the safety challenges and incorporating these protocols as much as possible.
That's San Francisco School Board President Gabriella Lopez. Gabriella, thanks and best of luck.
Thank you.
The U.S. and Russia have agreed to extend a treaty that restricts the arsenals of some of the deadliest weapons known to humankind. The New START treaty limits the number of long-range nuclear warheads and intercontinental ballistic missiles that each country can maintain until 2026. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said in a statement that the treaty reduces the risk of a costly, dangerous arms race. But does it go far enough? Here and now, security analyst Jim Walsh joins us now. He's with MIT's Security Studies program. Hi, Jim.
Good to be with you, Peter.
Good to have you. And the New START treaty dates back to 2010. Here's then-President Barack Obama at the signing in Prague.
Today is an important milestone for nuclear security and nonproliferation and for U.S.-Russia relations.
So now, Jim, the treaty extended for another 5 years. What will that do exactly?
Well, among other things, it limits the number of what are called deployed strategic warheads. That is, the weapons that are ready to fire at targets across the globe. And it limits those to roughly 1,500 for each side. It's technically 1,550, but we'll round it off at 1,500. Now, to be clear, the U.S. and Russia have thousands and thousands of other warheads not included in this treaty, tactical nuclear warheads, those in reserves, et cetera. But it does limit and verify what is loaded in the chamber, if as it were, and that's a big deal.
It is, because look, the treaty, as you say, doesn't do anything about shorter range nuclear weapons. I mean, is it really making the world safer?
No, it's a fair question, and I would answer it this way. It would be a big deal if it had expired. You know, as it is, things have been heading in the wrong direction for a while. Several landmark agreements have gone by the wayside, and so the whole enterprise was sort of teetering. And so if we had lost this, that would have been a major blow. But you're right. You know, it's good, but good doesn't represent progress. You know, a week ago, the U.S. and Russia together had something like, depending on how you count it, 13,000 nuclear warheads, enough to more than wipe out the planet. And today, we still have 13,000 nuclear warheads, enough to wipe out the planet. So good that it's stabilized, but there's a lot of work. And we seem to be skating. Our rate of progress has declined over time.
And it wasn't that long ago that the Trump administration had tried to renegotiate the deal on the condition that Russia address its entire arsenal and that the deal included China. Do you think it was wise for President Biden to renew without conditions?
Yes. I mean, they really didn't have much of a choice here. I mean, it takes years to negotiate a new treaty in the nuclear world. And they wanted to, as you say, make a new agreement, the Trump administration, and include a new member. But they waited to the last minute to sort of get serious about it, and then the clock ran out. So basically, Biden's choice was either extend or withdraw, and certainly extending was way, you know, a much better choice than junking the whole thing and, you know, opening up a bad world of arms racing. So I think it was the right move.
It is interesting to me to see these two rivals renew this treaty with relatively no conflict, considering the fraught relationship they have on other issues diplomatically.
Yeah, absolutely. But I would say the Biden approach, looking back, you'd have to call it a traditional approach. This kind of arms control is, or the New START Treaty, is really, essentially, an extension of work that goes back to the 1970s through Democratic and presidential administrations. And through all that time, Russia did bad things. I mean, Russia, the Soviet Union was really bad. Russia's bad. I could list all the things that are objectionable. Soviet Union was terrible. But in both cases, it was clear that mutual nuclear suicide was not an answer to their problems. So both countries have had to try to find ways to compete, to oppose each other, while simultaneously trying to reduce the risk of nuclear war and not stumble into something that ends up killing the planet.
Right. Well, some have criticized the administration for striking this deal with Russia just as that country is cracking down on dissent and putting Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny in prison. State Department spokesperson Ned Price pushed back on that idea yesterday.
As we engage Russia in ways that advance American interests, as I just said, we can also remain clear-eyed about the challenges that Russia poses. Even as we work with Russia to advance U.S. interests, so too will we hold Russia to account for its reckless and its adversarial behavior.
Jim, broadly speaking, what have you seen so far in the early days from the Biden administration in its relationship with Russia?
Well, again, I think they're trying to do two difficult things at the same time, which is you have no choice but to do it. Russia's a great power. It's not going anywhere. You know, it has 6,000 or 7,000 nuclear weapons. So you got to deal with reality as it presents itself. And nuclear weapons aren't going to solve, you know, the Russian human rights problem, which I think is a problem. So on things where Russia is bad, on cyber attacks, on Syria, on human rights, we need to go after them and pressure them and try to constrain their behavior. But it's in our interest and their interest not to let that competition spill over and affect the decisions we make on nuclear weapons, or we'll both be losers in the end. So I think almost any president is confronted with this when they're dealing with a Russia or a China. Compete and cooperate where the opportunities present themselves.
Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh, thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
Well, with a series of executive orders that address everything from climate change to immigration to COVID-19, President Biden has quickly begun to push his agenda forward. But progressive Democrats in the Senate say unless the filibuster is done away with, the president's more ambitious legislative goals will stall. WBUR's Anthony Brooks has our story about new energy to kill an old Senate tradition.
Once upon a time, the filibuster was part of a uniquely American idea of standing up for principle even if you're outnumbered. That theme was at the heart of Frank Capra's 1939 movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Jimmy Stewart plays a young, idealistic senator who tries to block passage of a corrupt appropriations bill with a talking filibuster, refusing to yield the Senate floor.
Yes, and a man even powerful enough to control congressmen, and I saw three of them in his room the day I went up to see him.
The senator yield.
No, sir, I will not yield.
Mr. Smith doesn't yield and holds the floor until he collapses with exhaustion, but his efforts expose the corruption and block the bill. Well, that's Hollywood, and yet Adam Gentleson says
it is an accurate depiction of how the filibuster was deployed in those days.
Gentleson is a progressive strategist who worked for Democratic Senator Harry Reid. He's the author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate, and The Crippling of American Democracy. Gentleson says over time, the filibuster has changed from a procedure that gave a senator a chance to persuade to one that allows the minority to block legislation supported by the majority. That's because in the Senate now, it takes 60 votes rather than a simple majority to stop debate and move a bill to an up or down vote.
You know, we've come to accept the 60-vote threshold as sort of a normalized part of the Senate. This is a recent thing.
The big change came during the push for civil rights when Southern senators used the filibuster to block civil rights legislation.
And that was the major contribution of the Jim Crow era by these Southern white supremacist senators to finally use the filibuster to actually stop bills altogether by raising the threshold for passage from a simple majority to a supermajority. And this is sort of the principal source of gridlock in our federal government today.
If Democrats don't push to reform or eliminate the filibuster, Gentleson says it will present a huge obstacle to Biden's agenda. Other progressives, including Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, agree.
the filibuster must go. It's something that's rooted in a racist past, and it's used today as a way of blocking the progressive agenda, which President Biden is proposing in environmental justice, racial justice, economic justice.
But the politics around this are fraught. With a filibuster gone, Senate Democrats could pass everything from tax reform to the Green New Deal with a simple majority. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says they'd pay a price.
When Republicans next control the government, we'd be able to repeal every bill that had just been rammed through. And we'd set about defending the unborn, exploring domestic energy, unleashing free enterprise, defunding sanctuary cities. You get the picture.
A number of moderate Democrats also oppose killing the filibuster. Richard Arenberg takes McConnell's warning seriously and says calls to kill the filibuster are short-sighted. Arenberg teaches at Brown University and spent more than 30 years working on Capitol Hill.
And it was never a time in all those years that I brought any kind of legislative proposal where the very first question I got back wasn't, who's my Republican co-sponsor? Because every senator understands if you're going to get anywhere with your legislative proposals, you need some buy-in from the other side.
Arenberg is co-author of the book Defending the Filibuster, The Soul of the Senate. With regard to how those segregationist senators used the filibuster, he says,
it was evil, immoral.
Arenberg says the behavior was evil, but not the procedure itself. He argues the filibuster cools the legislative temperature and offers a degree of protection for whichever party is out of power.
Progressives in the Senate who are now clamoring to get rid of the filibuster weren't doing that in 2017 when Trump took office with majorities in the House and the Senate. So that's why I say it's short-sighted.
Arenberg says polarization is at the root of the crisis in Washington, and killing the filibuster will only make it worse. On the other hand, use of the filibuster has spiked in the past decade, particularly by Republican minorities. So Democrats like Ed Markey are ready to push back.
I believe that ultimately it's inevitable that we have to repeal the filibuster.
Moderates might need convincing, but they'll face a tough choice. Give up on key parts of the Biden agenda or kill the filibuster. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, February 9th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
If you're never quite sure how to answer the question,
where are you from?
NPR's Rough Translation might be the podcast for you.
Yes, finally, someone else.
Give us your accents and your origin stories, your cross-cultural misfits, yearning to just be. And listen to Rough Translation on NPR.
The consulting firm McKinsey will pay $573 million to settle a multitude of state investigations into the aggressive marketing of opioids like OxyContin. McKinsey worked with Purdue Pharma and other drug companies to boost sales of prescription opioids despite well-documented health concerns. Federal data show at least 400,000 Americans have died from opioid overdoses since 1999. Let's bring in MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Ali, what are the marketing tactics McKinsey used that has made it a target of state attorneys general?
Well, there were a lot of documents, Callum, that showed that McKinsey counseled Purdue Pharma to target prescribers who had been already prescribing high numbers and high levels of prescription opiates. So the idea was they were sort of giving them a strategy to increase their sales. It's a very typical business strategy. Focus more on those customers who already do business with you and less on those who don't. So one could argue, and McKinsey did, that this was a strategy about sales. It had nothing to do with opioids particularly or extending the reach or the number of people who got opioids. We were just telling Purdue how to do it. But in the end, they have documents that show that McKinsey sent recommendations to Purdue in 2013 that the consultants said would boost the sales of these drugs by more than $100 million. And that's the connection between McKinsey, a consulting firm, and a firm that manufactured and distributed opioids.
I see. But even with the documents, Ali, I mean, it's unusual, right, for consulting firms to be held liable for what their clients do. I mean, McKinsey didn't face consequences for advising Enron, for example. So do you think this settlement sets a new precedent that consultants can be held responsible for the clients acting on their advice?
Yeah, it's certainly new ground. In fact, the Attorney General of Massachusetts, Maura Healey, who's been sort of a leader in this litigation, said in a statement that she actually sent to NPR, today's agreement sets a new standard for accountability in one of the most devastating crises of our time. So we've not seen this in the past. Companies always use consultancies. They have for decades. It's the first time we're seeing a consultancy share responsibility with the company. Now, it's nowhere close to the culpability that Purdue Pharmaceuticals has or Johnson & Johnson, other companies involved in this, but it is a big deal. It's in excess of $500 million.
And it's going to be split among, I believe, 47 states, D.C., some territories. What are they going to do with it? What do we know about what the money is for?
Well, $15 million is going to the Attorney General, the Association of State Attorney Generals, because they were bringing the legislation, the litigation forward. Most of the states will use it for things that mitigate the effect of the opioid crisis. That, you know, in the tobacco settlement all those years ago, there was some criticism that the money that the states got went in to fill budgetary holes in the states and didn't do anything for victims of the cigarette smoking advertising. There's a determination this time around to make sure that the money goes to programs that are either treatment programs or programs to get people off of opioids or public awareness programs. So hopefully things like rehabilitation programs, hopefully those are the ones that will benefit from the settlement.
I see. And for these states, it may be some of the first money that they're getting, because even though Purdue Pharma agreed last fall to pay $8.3 billion as it pleaded guilty to felony charges, it then filed for bankruptcy. So the states are having to line up with creditors to try to get their hands on that money. That's MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Ali, thank you.
Thanks, Cal.
I want to follow up on a story from last week about closed adoptions that really touched a nerve. Gabrielle Glazer's new book, American Baby, is about one woman's lifelong search for her son. In the 1960s, as a young unmarried mother, she was forced to place her baby for adoption, and the records were sealed. After our conversation with Gabrielle, we were flooded with responses like this one from Mary Sue Hayes in Colorado.
I'm crying right now because I'm trying to find my family. And it's been 35 years. Iowa refuses to open any records to find my family. And I'm 73. It's just heartbreaking.
We were moved by Mary Sue's message, but when we tried to call her back to learn more, we couldn't get through. We did hear from a man named York. He asked us not to use his full name because some people in his family aren't aware of his story. Last month, he says he got an email from his birth mother.
She says she's been looking for me her whole life. It's been wonderful. It's so bizarre. We are finding that we're ridiculously alike. We literally have the same truck. We have the same burgundy Toyota truck. I mean, that is crazy. It's just that feeling like this is my person, you know?
Before all this, York had done a DNA test that turned up one relative on his birth mother's side. So he sent her a message.
I'm looking for my biological mother. She would be related to you. You're my closest blood relative I've ever found. Do you know anyone who was 15 years old in 1968 and gave a child up for adoption in Southern California? And it could have been a family secret. And immediately she's just like, sorry, that's not ringing a bell. But then this woman had gone ahead and forwarded my email. And then it went to this one cousin and she immediately sent it to her sister because she knew. And that was all it took. Just steel yourself for whatever you find. Hope for joy. Be prepared for catastrophe. But in the end, in your life, it's so much better to know than not know.
Cheryl DeVries hasn't had as much luck.
Having moved back to the Seattle area where I was born, I did search for my biological mom. And at the time, we just had a Washington reunion agency that hires an intermediary to open your birth records and try to connect you. I went through all kinds of scenarios, like maybe she wouldn't be alive. Actually, that was the worst scenario I could think of. I never, ever thought she wouldn't want to know who I was. And that was a huge hurt to have that be what happened.
Cheryl hasn't given up hope. She's also submitted DNA samples with Ancestry and 23andMe. So far, no leads.
I think there's a part of me that just needs to see and smell and say some words and hear that story to feel somewhat satisfied. I don't, you know, and I just have such a big feeling of wanting to say thank you. It can't have been easy for her either.
And then there's the story of Joan Griffin. She told us her birth mother called out of nowhere one day. They kept in touch for years, but ended up having a falling out over politics. Her birth mother ended the relationship. Then, about a decade later, in 2019, Joan did a DNA test and found a close connection on her birth father's side.
And I crossed all my fingers. How is this going to work out? And it has been absolutely delightful. So for a year and a few months, I have been in like almost weekly contact with three brand new siblings. It's been an emotional roller coaster both times. I was a young mom myself when my birth mother entered my life and she came on really strong. It was initially very difficult and then became very good and valuable. And then, you know, it kind of went down the drain. Whereas this second one, because we're all older, and I think the silver lining of the pandemic has been that we've been forced to take it really slowly. And it feels very different. Feels very warm and inviting and inclusive.
Thank you to everyone who shared their stories. And now we want to hear from someone whose job it is to help people searching for their birth parents. Leah Larkin is a DNA genealogist. Leah, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
And we were so overwhelmed by the amount of responses that we got from that interview. So many people sharing the story of their own adoption and their own search. But I have a feeling that this would really come as no surprise to you, would it?
No, it really doesn't. There are an inordinate number of people who were either adopted and neither knew or never knew, or people who grew up only knowing one of their parents. It's pretty prevalent.
And how much has DNA technology then changed the game as people start searching for their past?
With the kind of DNA that we use for genealogy tests, you can find, for example, second or third cousins. And then with a little bit of elbow grease, so to speak, you can figure out how they're related to one another and then work your way back forward to figure out how you fit into the family. So before DNA, if you couldn't get your original adoption records or if you didn't know someone who knew the details, it was almost impossible to find your birth family if you were adopted. But now you just need to take a DNA test and then put a little effort into it.
Has that changed even more now that DNA testing has become relatively commonplace? In other words, like we've gotten to a point where there's so much data out there that if you do submit a sample, there's actually a pretty good chance that you might find somebody who you're related to.
Yeah, it's much easier if your family has been in the U.S. for a long time. It would be much harder if you were adopted from another country. But certainly if your family has been in the U.S. for, you know, 100, 150 years, there's a very good chance you're going to find DNA matches that are close enough that are going to lead you to your family.
Before you made this your full-time job, I understand that you were part of what you've described as an angel network that helps people on the internet track down their families. Can you describe what that means and what that community is like?
The term is search angel, and there are a huge number of people who either have been through adoption themselves or want to apply their genealogy passion to helping others. They will essentially either do the work for you or guide you through the work to help you find your biological parents. And I've made some wonderful friends that I'm still friends with years later, having been their search angel.
So walk me through this just a little bit. I'm curious how you suggest people approach their birth families once they've found them online or identified a DNA match, because I know this can be a very, very sensitive time for everybody involved. How should it happen? How should it go down?
My advice is to reach out in a way that gives the family a kind of room to save face, perhaps, if that's the right word, if they're not open to contact. When I reach out, I tend to have the adoptee do it, but I guide them through it. So when we reach out, the approach is along the lines of, you know, we've got these DNA matches that tie us to your family. Can you perhaps help us? And I always try to step back a generation or so. So for example, I've had cases where I knew who the birth father was, like there was no doubt. But instead of saying, we know you're the birth father, the contact was, we know who that we're descended from your grandparents. Can you help us? We've definitely had cases where the birth father in this particular case said, you know, no, I want nothing to do with this. We've also had cases where the birth father was like, we should talk, and called up the adoptee and said, yes, I'm your father, and I'm glad you found me.
If it does go well, what kind of potential does this have to change people's lives? People who are searching have, in many cases, been searching for years and years and years.
There are so many layers to it. Some people just want to know who they were, and there are people who just want medical history. And some people develop really warm and caring relationships with their biological families.
And how does it make you feel to help reunite people?
Wonderful. It's one of the most gratifying things that I've done. And I love being able to see, you know, years later, my adoptees meeting up with their sisters and brothers that they didn't know they had.
Leah Larkin, a DNA genealogist who helps adoptees searching for their birth families. Leah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a scene from the new film Judas and the Black Messiah, which had its world premiere at this year's Sundance Film Festival. But the pandemic caused this year's festival to be virtual rather than held at its usual home in Park City, Utah. It just wrapped up yesterday, and joining us to give us a report is Ayesha Harris, a host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Ayesha, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So good to have you along, and I'm hoping that you can start by telling us a bit about Judas and the Black Messiah.
Yes, it was one of my favorite things to check out at Sundance. And this film was directed by Shaka King. It stars Daniel Kaluuya as Fred Hampton, the Black Panther who was shot, unfortunately, and killed by FBI police in 1969. It's really, really fascinating to watch. I hope we'll be talking about it more.
Well, it's definitely one of the highlights coming out of the festival, and I'm hoping that you can underscore some of the other ones that also are getting a lot of attention. The musical documentary Summer of Soul comes to mind because it won the Grand Jury Prize for documentaries. So tell us a bit about that one.
It was such a treat to watch. It's about the Harlem Cultural Festival, which took place in 1969, and it's often dubbed as the Black Woodstock. And that's kind of underselling it. This was such a very, very pivotal moment in music history that was lost. It was recorded, but it, for whatever reason, it was held under wraps until now. So we're seeing all this footage for the first time. It's just such an amazing documentary to watch, and I really think people are going to love it once they get a chance to see it.
And I know that Summer of Soul isn't available to be seen just yet, which is too bad, but we can't resist playing some of the music from it. So I do want to play one of the many acts that appears in the film. This is Gladys Knight and the Pips doing their upbeat version of I Heard It Through the Grapevine. All right, Ayesha, you don't have to rely on the grapevine, though, or the rumor mill to know that Coda is also getting a lot of hype coming out of this film festival because it won the Grand Jury Prize. And it's about a teenager who is the only hearing member of her family. It's actually an acronym, right? Child of Deaf Adults. So tell us more about this one.
Yes, this was what I would consider sort of a definitive Sundance film. It is a crowd pleaser. It's a coming of age story. It's directed by Sean Hader, and it stars Amelia Jones as Ruby. And it's a really beautiful story about Ruby trying to find her way both as a member of this family, but also as her own person.
You know, the film's a reminder too, Aisha, that there's been a lot of conversation in recent years at Sundance and elsewhere about diversity and representation. So I'm curious whether CODA, with its cast of people who actually are deaf, by the way, right? They weren't just actors playing deaf characters. Did that reflect the broader selection at Sundance, or was it kind of a one-off?
Oh, absolutely. I think Sundance is one of those festivals that in recent years has done a really great job of increasing the storytelling that it is representing women, people of color, disabled people. We're seeing so many different stories here. And one of the things that I loved seeing was the movie Passing. This was a story based on Nella Larsen's 1929 novel about two Black women, and one of whom is able to pass for white. And I thought it was one of the most beautiful films at Sundance. It's shot in black and white. There's a beautiful score. That's one of the things that we get to see at Sundance, is those stories that we wouldn't normally see or that are often underrepresented in film and television.
And Passing was one of those really strong films that didn't come away with some hardware, but there were a lot of good films, right, Aisha, that maybe didn't win an award but are still worth watching for. What are a couple of other ones that maybe popped to mind?
Well, a couple of my favorites include Cusp, which is a documentary about three teen girls in Texas. It was directed by Parker Hill and Isabel Bethencourt. And I thought it was just really fascinating to be with these actual teen girls who are just so candid and open about what it's like to be on the cusp of girlhood. And another one for me that I really enjoyed was Pleasure. And this was directed by the Swedish director Ninja Tyberg. And it starred Sofia Kappel as a Swedish immigrant who comes to the U.S. with the express purpose of being a giant adult film star. So those are two films that I really enjoyed, got a lot out of, and I hope people are able to see within the coming months.
Aisha, the last thing I'm curious about is that, you know, I know this isn't your first time at Sundance. You've gone in the past when it was an in-person event. And so I'm curious what the pluses and minuses of going virtual are in your view, and whether you could see a format change being a long-term change.
Well, the plus is that I got to see way more films than I would have otherwise. The downside, of course, is that it can make watching uninterrupted very difficult. Hopefully, if they do virtual, that will give more people the ability to see films who couldn't maybe afford to go to Sundance. But also, I think that you can't discount the importance of being in the theater and also being able to see other people and be around other people. So I can see Sundance incorporating a virtual component to it in future years, but I'm sure as soon as we can all get back out there, they're going to want us out there.
Well, we look forward to that day, and we thank you for transporting us to this virtual Sundance Film Festival this year as well. That's Aisha Harris of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Aisha, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.